I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, Portland's community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patrick Kohlberg is engineering. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Today, Bill Resnick interviews Mark Brenner, the director of Labor Notes, a nonprofit organization for rank-and-file union members and grassroots activists. They were discussing the reasons why many working-class people who voted twice for Obama voted for Trump this time. Following that, Jan Hawken talks with Sheldon George, professor of English at Simmons College in Boston, about his new book, Trauma and Race, a Lacanian Study of African-American Racial Identity. They discuss the murder in 2012 of an African-American young man, Jordan Davis, by an older white man following an argument over rap music. George uses this case to illustrate how psychoanalytic theory can help us understand more deeply the ways that racialized imagery and racialized identities operate politically. Lori Bolden will be reviewing an Ian McEwan book entitled Enduring Love. It's an in-depth study of how much biology and history determine our view of what is and how unreliable memory is, couched in a sort of mystery and infused with the battle between reason and spirit and emotional existence. I'll conclude today's program with an article entitled The Reality of Fake News by Benoit Carmbach. For music interviews today, we'll be playing a couple of songs that reflect the darkening American mood of the U.S. populace. But now here's Bill Resnick with Mark Brenner.
Hi, Mark Brenner. Welcome to KBOO.
Oh, Bill, so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Mark Brenner is the director of Labor Notes. Labor Notes is a monthly journal working to put the movement back in the labor movement. Many of you know Labor Notes Network that holds Troublemakers School. There's going to be a Troublemakers School in Portland this coming spring, 2017. They also do the Labor Notes Great National and International Conference. It'll be in spring 2018. It's every 2 years in Chicago. They are wonderful revival meetings, among many other things.
We're trying, Bill. We can't organize fast enough.
Well,
here.
You're from North Carolina. You know how to do a revival.
I've been to tent revivals. Yes, I have.
Mark, you've been watching for, 20, 25 years now, the relentless attack on workers, destruction of labor unions. That's a prime goal of Republicans, often aided by Democrats. Now we have Trump and a Republican Congress and likely a Republican Supreme Court. Law doesn't matter. It's what the Republicans think should be done. First, we need to discuss what they might do, this whole machine, to destroy the labor unions in particular. And then we'll go into what can be done, how the labor movement and progressives in general have actually a great opportunity now to rebuild a fighting left. So, Mark, what might this Republican machine do? What are the near-term struggles?
Well, they've been waiting for a generation for these stars to align to have such a conservative Congress and a president that is certainly not on the same political page as Paul Ryan and many of the other leaders, but is perfectly happy to go along with their agenda. I think that for the labor movement, the probably biggest immediate threat, because it's so easy for this Congress to do, is to pass national right-to-work legislation. We've seen this in the conservative playbook time and again in recent years. Mike Pence, actually in Indiana, was a big proponent of the Indiana right-to-work law. In Michigan, with the fight that we had there. Scott Walker, most famously, in Wisconsin. Every state across the Rust Belt has actually made this a sort of a stump speech promise, every conservative politician, and I think they're going to bring that to Washington and try and spread this. What right to work does, it outlaws the ability for unions to negotiate what we call union security clauses, namely that everybody who works in the workplace is a member of the union, and that is now going to be challenged legally, and it's going to make it a lot harder. Certainly, right to work is not a death sentence for the labor movement. I mean, there are plenty of right to work states where unions are strong, and we see a lot of organizing, like Nevada. You look no further than the culinary workers in Las Vegas, and you can see what is possible in a right to work environment. But unfortunately, we're in a labor movement where too many union leaders are really disconnected and disengaged with their membership. And in that kind of environment, where people see the union as something that is far away from them and doesn't really listen, when you're getting clobbered at work every day, why wouldn't you vote with your feet? So that's the real risk, first and foremost, I think, out of this Congress with this president.
What right to work does, though, ultimately, is defund the unions. There's an enormous drop in their dues.
Well, that's the way that's the way the Republicans think of it, because they see unions as a political force, right? These are the people who fund the Democrats, who fund our opponents. These are the people who organize the sort of ground game for the Democratic Party, which is absolutely true. There would be no Democratic Party in the Midwest and in many other states if there wasn't the labor movement that we have.
The teachers' unions, in fact, provide nearly everybody at the Democratic National Convention of those 20,000 people.
Labor is absolutely overrepresented in the delegations. There's no question about that. Unlike everywhere else in American life, that's the one place where you see a lot of union members. But it's not just right to work. I mean, that will absolutely be a body blow if they can get it passed, because so many unions are not ready for it. And unfortunately, we kind of had a dress rehearsal for that last year. There was a Supreme Court case that was basically going to do the same thing in the public sector, except for the death of Antonin Scalia. It would have most likely been decided against the labor movement, and it would have created the same division in the public sector unions that right to work creates in the private sector. And most unions sort of treated this like, oh, all we need to do to get ready is we need a better sales pitch, and we need to figure out some tech-savvy ways to collect dues from our members and sign people up on the web. It's a lot bigger than that. People join and stick with unions that are fighting unions. And I think that, unfortunately, too few labor leaders, too few union activists have been able to get that message across. We need to actually be standing up. We need to be active. We need to be visible in the workplace. We need to be fighting back and winning. That's how people are going to stick with the union in a right-to-work environment. If Friedrichs was the dress rehearsal, this court case I was telling you about it that failed because of Scalia's death, then I think we've got a lot to worry about. But fortunately, there's a lot more unions that are, I hope, learning that lesson, and we're certainly shouting that from the rooftops. But by no means is right to work the only thing we've got to worry about, Bill. Things are going to be a lot tougher before they get better.
Let's talk about that, and let's talk about what a fighting union is, which is really requires a very active, knowledgeable membership. There's lots of resources actually out there, and many unions, in fact, do their best to make sure that they don't have an active membership, because those people might want to, in fact, replace the old leadership.
Exactly. Too many labor union leaders are looking over their shoulder, worried about who's the competition, why am I going to develop that steward, why am I going to give them those skills because they might run against me in the next election, which is a real unfortunate mindset.
Yeah, I can't create a fifth column within the union that is ultimately going to consume my position.
Yeah, and this is part of the problem with the fact that too many union leaders look at it exactly like what you said. It's my position. It somehow belongs to me. I got this spot. And I can't underscore enough too, Bill. Remember, at least in the bigger unions, when you get elected to office, you come off the job. You're not working on the hospital floor, the night shift anymore. You're not on the assembly line anymore. You're sitting in the union office. You don't live under the contract you're negotiating. Take Jimmy Hoffa Jr., the head of the Teamsters Union. He doesn't have to see his pension get cut in half like some of the Teamsters in the central part of the country are. And I think that contributes to part of why they hold so dearly onto these positions, because they know that they don't want to go back to work. They don't want to actually punch the clock. They've gotten comfortable. They're making, in some cases, way too much money, given what their members are making. And this is fortunately shifting in our direction. This is something Labor Notes has been talking about since our founding in 1979. We see it as a big problem. We've been talking about how to fix it. And I think more and more union activists recognize it and get it and have been trying to steer the ship in a different direction. But there's a lot of unions out there. We still have a lot of work to do to really connect our organizations with the members, to really put them in the driver's seat of our union movement.
It'll be a very tumultuous and difficult, though, transition to that fighting union. And in the short term, I I'm hoping that you people are really going to be inspiring, that Labor Notes will inspire that.
We're trying, okay. Bill. I mean, but I will say, like, this is a tough sell. Think about it. Most people who run for union office, even if you run as a reformer, I'm going to, you know, cut salaries. I'm going to be responsive. You know, we have a 24-hour workforce, you know, 24/7 workforce. We're going to have a 24/7 union. All of those promises, all of those pledges that you might make to your membership, members are great. They're like, great. Bill, I'm going to elect you to solve my problems. And then when you go back to them, you know, after the election's over and you won and you say, hey, it doesn't work like that. We got to do this together. Most people, they take that as very hard to hear. They're like, nah, I voted for you to fix that problem. I want you to do that, right? And to say this has got to be something that you do, that we do together, that is a much tougher message to get across. But it's the only way forward, Bill.
And it requires a really different consciousness in many ways that can, however, be developed.
Absolutely. We've got a lot of examples, and it's really, I think, quite encouraging times.
Let's talk about some of the examples and how, in fact, the labor movement can reconstruct itself. This is KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Mark Brenner, who's the director of Labor Notes, a monthly journal putting the movement back in the labor movement. And Labor Notes has Troublemakers School coming up in Portland this spring. They do them all over the country and a national conference in 2018 in Chicago. Mark, let's go to what can be done. You pointed out that there's lots of unions, even in right-to-work states, that are doing quite well, that mobilize their workers. My sense of them is that some of the unions become, in some ways, a secular version of a religious institution, giving people hope, giving people a sense of their capacity, giving people a community to live in, but of course around secular goals of a really much better and democratic life. I mean, that's the kind of union I think that we want.
Bill, you don't have to look any further than the teachers right here in Portland. You remember the big struggle they had a couple years ago with the district over their contract. They were fighting for a vision that inspired the community. And even though they had Democratic Party operatives, they had, you know, hired guns from the Oregonian and from the television stations working for the district, they had million-dollar lawyers on the other side, they still generated a tremendous amount of popular support. And the reason they did it is because they were active and engaged and mobilized, not like a faucet where the leadership turned it on and turned it off. Folks were doing stuff all on their own. And one of the reasons that they did that, Bill, that's really important, is because the union really started with, what do we believe on behalf of our kids? What are we fighting for? And to do that, they also talked about one of the most important union values that we've got, which is an injury to one is an injury to all. And I see that even today in the teachers union here in Portland and many other unions around the country, that if you can build that sort of sense of solidarity, make it a real thing, and really take that out from the union hall to the community, it can be a tremendous force.
Yeah, the teachers unions that are doing well, like in Chicago, they've all adopted that slogan. Philadelphia and Chicago and Portland students deserve, and we teachers want to build them, and here's how we would do it. It's a wonderful rallying cry. And in fact, they also make the effort. People like their teachers. That's one of the things. Teachers are in contact with parents. One of the strengths of the teachers union is this enormous community context all the time, particularly in the elementary schools. Other unions don't have, though, that degree of community contact and provide the kinds of service that parents and the whole community so desperately want. But tell us about some other unions that have maintained this very strong activist presence and commitment by their members.
Well, like I said, I think that whether it's hotel workers in Las Vegas or whether it's teachers in Portland, even truck drivers and telephone techs. We just had this huge strike in New York where I live with the Verizon workers. It was actually up and down the East Coast. I don't know if you followed it last spring. But it was a great example of how when unions are organized internally, when members are, you know, clear about what they're doing and they're willing to pick a big fight over something that matters not just to them but to their entire community, they can win. Here you had workers striking against a multi-billion dollar company. Verizon makes $1 billion in profit every month, Bill, and they were coming after a generation's worth of healthcare benefits and wages and pensions. And these workers said, how in the world can you be one of the richest companies in our country and not treat us fairly? And they were willing to stand on the picket lines for almost a month and some change to do that. And they won. They won against all the odds. I never would have predicted that they could be that they could beat Verizon hands down, but they did.
You know, that sort of fairness motive, the fairness demand, it's very, very powerful. And we saw it, in fact, in this last election. I mean, Trump won. But in fact, if you look at the larger picture of the election, it was an enormous populist eruption from working people, basically. Part of it, of course, was rightist and contributed to Trump's victory. But the Bernie Sanders campaign almost upended and would have if it weren't for all of the various dirty tricks that the Clinton camp was able to successfully do. It seems to me there's really, within the sort of the working class of this country, there's the opportunity for actually reconstructing a progressive movement.
I couldn't agree with you more, Bill. I mean, I look at the Bernie Sanders campaign with so much admiration and inspiration because, you know, I've known Bernie Sanders. He's a Labor Notes subscriber. He's spoken at our events. He's been around much longer than, you know, this election would lead you to believe, obviously, as a senator, but as a movement person. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating about it, one of the things that I think progressives sometimes don't even believe in their own heart, is that most people agree with us. They agree that bankers and billionaires and corporate CEOs and the politicians that are bought and paid for by these folks shouldn't be in charge of our country, that we live in the richest country in the history of humanity. Why can't everybody have health care? Why can't we have the best schools on the planet? Why can't we actually tackle big problems like climate change? I mean, look, if we could put a man on the moon, how is it that we can't figure out how to put solar panels on every public building in America? These are the kind of questions that Sanders was asking, and the fact that he was raising our expectations, that he was asking us to aim higher, was really, I think it spoke to a hunger that's out there that I think we can tap both in the labor movement, because certainly he had tremendous support among unionists. Union activists were turning out in droves to be part of his campaign in ways that I have not seen in my 20-plus years in the labor movement, and in the general population, especially among young folks, which I think is even more encouraging.
And especially, it seems to me, in, quote, the blue states, there are tremendous opportunities now to secede. You know about secession in North Carolina. Well, we can't secede from the United States, but we can secede from the policy directions on a state level. It seems to me there are tremendous opportunities now for raising the minimum wage, for changing all sorts of work rules, for empowering working people, for dealing with climate change and health care at a state level. For every dollar that Trump gives to his rich 1%, states can tax it, raise their income taxes to meet on the same groups that got the gain, which will be a tremendous amount of resources that can actually go for good things. There are real opportunities, especially there and even at the legislative level. I mean, that's one part of it. Why don't you sum up, Mark?
Well, I think two things are really, really key here, Bill. One is that we have to actually act, right? And for the labor movement, for unions, first thing we've got to do is get our own house in order. Members have been too far removed, too disengaged for far too long. And if we don't actually recruit exponentially more leaders in this effort of ours, it's really still going to remain the kind of astroturf politics that we've seen coming out of this elite political class that runs the Democratic Party. And I think that for us as a union movement, I think there's some other really important things that we need to do aside from, you know, pushing very aggressively the kinds of audacious policy measures that you're talking about. We also negotiate contracts with thousands of employers around the country. I believe every union in America should be actually pushing contract language across the table that protects workers based on their immigration status, that allows for religious expression. These are things that matter a lot for immigrant members, for Muslim union members, but they also send a really powerful signal of solidarity. Like, we are not going to stand by while people target our communities, target people in our organizations. An injury to one is an injury to all. And these things can be incredibly powerful. Like the Fight for 15 movement, most people don't actually really realize. One of the key moments in that fight, long before they actually won a $15 minimum wage at the SeaTac airport, which was really one of the first, Seattle airport campaign was really the beginning of the spread of the $15 an hour campaign from Seattle everywhere. But one of the precursors to that was organizing car rental workers, many of whom were Somali Muslims, who were being targeted by their employer because they wanted to take their prayer breaks, and there was a lot of actual harassment. And the union organized, it was actually led by a community organization, and then the union recognized that it needed to get on board and actually embrace this sort of fight for freedom of religious expression. And those folks became some of the real partisans of this campaign. And that's exactly the kind of spirit that we need to take first inside of our union and then outside. Like, we need to be the anchor of rapid response networks that are defending immigrant workers targeted by a Trump administration who's promised to deport 3 million people. We need to be there when Muslim communities are being targeted. We need to be the anchor of all of those defense efforts. But I can't leave without saying one thing about the party and the election that you brought up that I just want to put a real important point on. Labor has spent billions of dollars over the years on elections and Democratic Party campaigns and candidates, and we have a very precious little to show for it. I think one of the things that we cannot do is let this election pass without a thoroughgoing examination of what happened. I always come back to this town hall meeting I watched on C-SPAN once, where Arlen Specter, a Republican who turned independent, was talking to people in his district about what was the proposal for what is now Obamacare. And one of his constituents just was outraged and was yelling at him. And he was like, "You and the people up there in Washington, you're going to do what you want to do and what the people who pay you want you to do. You don't care about us." And it was this incredibly visceral expression of the alienation that most folks have from the political parties, from the political professionals. And I think this election was an incredible rejection in both parties of that establishment, that elite. And I think that the Bernie Sanders campaign was another expression of that. And I think that there's a tremendous, as we were saying before, tremendously fertile ground for a different kind of politics that is much more rooted in working class values, in an ambitious vision of what this country could be. And if we miss the opportunity to steer our forces and our efforts in that direction, shame on us. Another thing we have to actually do, Bill, is we have to, in terms of bringing our members into the union and making them really feel like they're in the driver's seat, is we can't ignore the elephant in the room. Hillary Clinton got the lowest percentage of votes from union households since 1980, and a lot of union members, 43% nationally and a majority in swing states like Ohio, voted for Trump. And I think that we need to actually have a lot of conversations, sometimes very uncomfortable ones, about why that is. And we can't whitewash what's been going on in our country, and we can't ignore the racism and xenophobia and sexism of the Trump campaign. But we also, at our peril, ignore a huge chunk of our membership. And if you couldn't figure out a way to build a real base of solidarity around values like an injury to one is an injury to all, and really help people understand and engage with the issues like police violence, with what Trump is really going to do to our brothers and sisters who maybe don't have documentation, or to our Muslim brothers and sisters. If you can't do that inside of an organization like our unions, I don't know where you can do it. But I think another reason we have to do that is because these are the folks who are the base for this disaffected vote against the people who run everything. I mean, that's who they are.
A lot of people are angry at sort of the white now, see the white working class as completely infected by this racism and misogyny, including, in fact, some of the women within those apparatuses. They're shocked by it, and they see it just as an expression of this primitive sort of racism and sexism. And
I've seen a lot of those same stories, Bill. I've heard a lot of people try and explain this as a vote for racism, as a sort of simple, clear expression of the racism of the white working class. And I'm sorry, I don't think it's that simple. When you have Barack Obama, the man whose middle name is Hussein, winning Youngstown, Ohio, part of this long-standing unionized blue-collar white working class by 22 points.
Yeah, counties all over the Rust Belt who voted for Obama twice and now are now voted for Trump. That's very... What, explain the significance of that.
Well, it's what we were saying earlier, that this is not just, it's not simply a vote for a guy who expresses white pride. I think that for a lot of people, you know, unpacking what it means, you know, what is racism and xenophobia really are, and actually getting folks to confront that is going to be, as I said, a challenge. We've got to do that with a lot of uncomfortable conversations. But I think that just saying that's what folks were voting for, you know, misinterprets what's happening in these communities, and it misinterprets a lot of this election, because as strong, I believe, was this rejection of class, of political operatives and professionals that are running both parties. And there's this profound sense of alienation that people have from not just D.C., like them, but the whole process. I mean, hell, let's not forget, half the country didn't vote. Those folks are also part of this alienated block that we need to be talking about. Why is it that people don't think that whatever happens with this election, it's going to have any benefit for them? Because more often than not, that's exactly what happened.
A lot of that's rage, is the rage of what's happened to their lives and become so much more precarious, seeing their kids not being able to afford their education or even get a decent job, seeing their own retirement benefits depleting, and seeing their communities getting destroyed.
Right, when you've had a wrecking ball swinging through your community for three decades and Hillary Clinton shows up and wants to talk about tweaking earned income tax credit, that is not an appeal to you as a voter. This is a five-alarm fire in your neighborhood, and folks are rolling up with very milquetoast solutions to the dire problems that you find yourself in. And I think that's part of what is exciting to me about the Sanders campaign, was I believe that Sanders very clearly recognized that people who are in this kind of crisis need ambitious solutions to very deep problems. They don't need milquetoast. They need something much stronger. And he offered that to them, and I think they turned out in droves for that. And I think the labor movement, I think the progressives more generally, should take that lesson very strongly to heart.
Mark Brenner, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Always great to be at KBOO.
It was a great revival meeting here at KBOO at 9 o'clock here, pre-recording Thursday, November 17th.
Always glad to be here, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Very good talking to you. Thanks.
You too.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now, Jan Hocken interviews Sheldon George on his new book, Trauma and Race, Lacanian Study of an American Racial Identity.
Sheldon George, welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, you teach African-American literature, American literature, and cultural studies at Simmons, and you draw on literature in calling for collective ways of working through histories of racist trauma. And in your recent book, Trauma and Race, you draw on psychoanalysis in this project of rethinking trauma, but also identity politics. So let's start with a story that opens your book. You begin with the death of Jordan Davis in 2012, a 17-year-old African-American young man who was killed by a white man after an argument with Davis and two of his friends over rap music. Can you tell us about this case and how to think psychoanalytically about the violence that unfolded in this drama?
Well, what interested me in the case was the sort of excessiveness in the response of Michael Dunn, who is a 40-something-year-old white male who is coming back from a wedding reception for his son. And he stops at a gas station, and Davis and his friends are in their SUV. They're playing their music really loud. And he says to them, please turn it down. And so they do. But then they turn it back up. And it escalates into an argument. And eventually, Michael Dunn pulls his gun out of his glove compartment. He fires 10 shots at the SUV as it's retreating. And three shots hit Jordan Davis. One of them hit him in the liver, killed him instantly, and as they're running away, Dunn is still shooting. So there's something excessive happening there. And what's interesting about the case is that the case doesn't directly address race. In the trial, in the initial trial, he's tried twice, but in the initial trial, the judge instructs the jury that they cannot take race into consideration, that what they have to focus on is fear. And the state attorney describes what was at stake. She says basically a person in Dunn's position doesn't have to see something. He doesn't have to see an actual weapon. There just has to be reasonable fear. And so Dunn says he feared for his life. He thought they had a gun, although no gun was found. And basically what ends up happening is that Dunn is found guilty of attempted murder for the two friends who survived the incident, but the jury mistries on the charge of murder for actually succeeding in killing Jordan Davis. And so this happens at the tail end of the George Zimmerman verdict, and it seems to confirm the notion that African-American lives are not valued. So what is really interesting about the case, though, is that it doesn't seem to have a direct focus on race, even though race is so prominent in it. And I think what ends up happening is that we see that race has taken on a new language in contemporary discourse. It's a language in which we no longer talk about the racial other in terms of their body, but we tend to talk about them in terms of their culture. And so Michael Dunn talks about rap culture, the rap music that they're playing. He describes the boys as rude and obnoxious. He says he was asking for a common courtesy. And so his response gets cast as an effort to police black culture.
There's also quite a bit of contention in this case that I think gives it its resonance around defending public ground and, public space, claiming and holding public space. And, of course, Florida's Hold Your Ground law that also has versions in Texas and Arizona is very much in play. That, and in a sense, African-Americans have created popular culture and brought it into even rap, the mainstream. And so there is this contest over identity around controlling public space, both in the narrow legal sense, but I think you're saying there's also some resonance around the symbolic aspects of rap music and this guy feeling kind of trapped in his car in the gas station with these rowdy kids claiming public space.
I think one way of understanding race is as something that has both social and psychic import. And so part of what happens in this case is that the sense of confinement, the sense of a loss of control, resonates with something psychic in Dunn. I'm using Lacanian theory to think about this case. And Lacanian theory,
which for those who don't know is one of the primary schools or major schools of thought in psychoanalysis in the psychoanalytic tradition.
Right. It's a theory that focuses on language as what shapes one's identity, one's sense of self. And Lacanian theory argues that we are all subjects who are split by language. So language gives us a conscious sense of self, but separates us from the unconscious. And so there's this part of us that is excluded from conscious interaction. And the unconscious drives and motivates our conscious activities in ways that we are not aware of. And part of what happens to the subject, because there's this element of the self that the self lacks access to, is that the subject feels a sense of lack, a sense of fragmentation. And what I argue...
And you're saying this is, to some extent, universal and not itself an effect of trauma, other than, I guess, the trauma comes into what people are able to do with that sense of lack of control or something missing within the self.
Right. So race becomes a way of mediating that sense of lack. So, for example, in creating a racial identity, part of what you're doing is sort of constructing a composite self, a complemented self. You are seeking out someone who is the complement of you, someone who is like you, who makes you feel whole, who makes you feel complete, a member of your own group. And I think what has happened historically is that whiteness as a concept has been a way of unifying American national identity. And it exists in opposition to blackness, which is an identity that discursively presents African Americans often with a sense of lack, with a sense of not being fully human, fully complete. I mean, this is the discourse that's coming out of slavery.
And you're saying that gets projected, that lack on the part of the white subject gets projected onto black people as the recipient for what's disowned in oneself. But you also started with this idea of excess, and there's also this complementary side to these race identity dynamics, white identity dynamics of seeing the excesses of aggression, of sexuality, of pleasure, projecting that onto black people, which seems to be what's operating dynamically in the Michael Dunn Jordan Davis confrontation. How do you understand that relationship between projecting what's missing in the dominant subject onto the oppressed, as well as projecting an excess, a frightening excess onto them?
So the sense here is that the subject feels as though they are lacking, as though they are missing something. And the thing that is missing in them gets projected onto the other. So if it's projected to someone who is of one's own race, then the sense is that if I bond with that person who is of my own race, then I can unify with them, they are my complement, I can become whole. But if I find that the other, the racial other, has this thing that is absent from me, that is lacking, this thing that can make me whole, then what you end up with is a sense of the other as having access to something excessive, something extra, something that doesn't belong to them, something that is rightfully mine. And this is part of what we see in the Dunn case, where Dunn ends up in prison as he's waiting for trial, and he describes all of the prisoners, who he says are mostly African American, as individuals who are there for armed robbery. And so his sense is that they have stolen something. They've stolen something that really belongs to whites. And this is part of what he's experiencing as he's there in the gas station listening to the music. The music is pounding. It's occupying a space that should be occupied by white Americans. And he has returned to this neighborhood after having lived there for a period of time and then moving away. And so it is a space that is rightfully his, but now it's dominated by the sound, the pleasures, the modes of enjoyment of racial others that seem alien to him.
And so there are these dynamics of not only hate and fear, but envy that has been part of this line of analysis that you're describing. And before we conclude for today, I'd like you to say a little more about what psychoanalysis contributes to identity politics, particularly around the instability of these identities, because I think there can be a complaint with identity politics, whether it's based on sexual orientation, race, gender, ethnicity, that these become too fixed and politically defended, which is often necessary. But you call for recognizing something much more unstable and fluid through the lens of psychoanalysis. Can you say a bit about how you would approach identity politics generally?
Yes, I think historically African Americans have found the need to create, to adhere to race as a source of unity a source of unifying politically. So this is what W.E.B. Du Bois finds. You know, there's a moment in his thinking where he says we must conserve racial identity, the identity that was given to us by slave masters, the identity that was the source of our oppression. We must conserve it. We must redefine it. And so he finds a political utility in racial identity. And I would agree that there is this political utility. Obviously, you need to unify if you're going to create change. But my argument would be that racial identity does not only have social import, it also has psychic import. And so part of the struggle that African Americans face, indeed the paradox that confronts them, is that in clinging to racial identity, they also expose themselves to a traumatic past. The traumatic past is always present.
And can dominate in ways that are limiting, you're saying. And and I think we might, in return to this, recognize that there have been many other alliances over time, particularly around social class and, of course, the Rainbow Coalition of Jesse Jackson campaign and campaigns now that perhaps open up a wider, more flexible, open-ended history around this. In concluding, I just want to make a pitch for your book. Sheldon, I'm talking today with Sheldon George, author of Trauma and Race, a Lacanian Study of African American Racial Identity. It's a wonderful book, a tough read, but as I used to tell my students when they would gasp reading psychoanalytic feminist theory, that you don't have to understand every theoretical move in a book or every passage to get something out of it. So I encourage people to pick up the book. And thank you so much, Sheldon George, for being with us today, and keep up your efforts.
Thank you for having me.
If you are the dealer, I'm out of the game. If you are the healer, means I'm broken and lame. If thine is the glory, then mine must be the shame. You want it darker.
That was, of course, the late, great Leonard Cohen with a song on his latest album, You Want It Darker, We Kill the Flame. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Now Larry Bolden reviews a 1990 novel by Ian McEwan entitled Enduring Love.
Good morning. I want to talk to you this morning about a superb novel of ideas by Ian McEwan, Enduring Love. He might also have named it Obsessive Love, for it turns out to be an examination of a form of erotomania named after the French psychiatrist de Clairambault. But more generally, it is, like his earlier novel, Black Dogs, an analysis of the psychological division and tension between clear, cool reason and emotion such as rage, love, and faith. McEwan's brother holds a Ph.D. and professorship in philosophy, and as you readers must know, McEwan is much interested in science, as is made manifest in his novels Solar and Saturday. What he often casts is a conflict between two characters, say a no-nonsense realist and an advocate of blind faith, is, I think, a struggle McEwan has with himself between the black dogs of hard reason and emotion. In this particular novel, he offers many fascinating asides on psychology of belief, especially religious belief, the reliability of memory, and even of immediate experience via the senses. Because the novel is also a mystery of sorts in which the tension builds gradually and inexorably, I don't intend to say much about the actual story. Suffice it to say that, like Saturday, the novel begins explosively with an event that shocks and shatters the observers. In this case, the sudden appearance of a helium balloon that comes to ground in a large field on the outskirts of London, witnessed by a number of observers who race to the scene to try to rescue the balloonist and his grandson who is still inside the basket. Wind gusts threaten to relaunch the balloon and take it over an escarpment and possibly into overhanging power lines. Five men struggle to keep the balloon grounded until the boy can be rescued. But as it becomes airborne again, one by one they release the ropes they are hanging to in their vain attempt to keep it grounded. One of the men, Joe Rose, is tormented by guilt about finally letting his rope go in order to save his life. Another man hangs on even when the others have let go in order to save themselves. Alone, there is no chance that he can bring the balloon to ground again. But by the time he cannot any longer retain his grip on the rope, he's too high and plunges to his death as others look on helplessly. As always, the story itself is gripping, but I was much more interested in the questions McEwen raises about memory and perception, philosophical and psychological questions that his character Joe Rose raises as he struggles with his own guilt feelings and tries to deal also with being the object of an obsessive and irrational love from one of the other would-be rescuers. As Joe reflects on the reliability of memory, he descends into a kind of Cartesian skepticism regarding not only memory but also of so-called direct perception. Quoting from the book, "No one could agree on anything. We lived in a mist of half-shared, unreliable perception, and our sense data came warped by a prism of desire and belief, which tilted our memories, too. We saw and remembered in our own favor, and we persuaded ourselves along the way. Pitiless objectivity, especially about ourselves, was always a doomed social strategy. We've descended from the indignant, passionate tellers of half-truths, who, in order to convince others, simultaneously convinced ourselves. When it didn't suit us, we didn't agree on what was in front of us." And further, quoting again, "Neuroscientists report that subjects able to recall a scene while under a magnetic resonance imaging scanner show intense activity in the visual cortex. But what a sorry picture memory offers. Barely a shadow, barely in the realm of sight, the echo of a whisper." Close quote. Kant may have been the first philosopher to point out that, contrary to common belief, memory is not like a camera. It is not a reproductive faculty, but more a creative one. He calls it a synthetic faculty that essentially makes up a narrative from the very limited data offered. While the memory may become sharper with repeated tellings, that is not due to an ability to analyze the memory, save for more detail, but a supposed clarity or certainty that simply becomes more fixed with each retelling, no matter how true to reality the memory actually is. Memory is less a picture of the past than a drawing or painting. Those in the grips of Clairembaut's syndrome take even denial of reciprocity from the loved one as a kind of signal of repressed or hidden love. Facial gestures or completely innocent actions by the beloved are taken as signs of love. Nothing can count as counter-evidence to the obsessed lover. Another line of the story not mentioned yet, but pivotal to the action, is the effect the obsession has on the love between Joe and his partner, Clara. She eventually comes to doubt Joe's claims about being followed by Perry and receiving letters and phone calls from him. When he tells her of his research into the syndrome and tries to warn her of impending danger, she's dismissive in her replies. Quote, "You think you can read your way out of this. Don't you realize you've got a problem?" Close quote. Will the heretofore strong and passionate love Clara and Joe have shared survive this intervention in their lives? Will it survive Joe's obsession with his stalker? These and other questions in this intriguing story readers will have to discover for themselves. I'm not sure how I missed this novel written in the 90s. I thought I had read all of McEwen, but I was delighted to have come across it, and I recommend it to you as one of his best. I've been talking about Ian McEwen's Enduring Love. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Fake news has been in the news a lot of late. Fake news does not imply highly biased opinion pieces, but deals in absolute factual lies. Such fake news has always existed, but in the age of the internet and online news sources, almost anybody can get into the act. The motivations to do so range from the strictly monetary to political subterfuge. Either way, cynicism about what is true and what is not will further corrode trust at all levels of public discourse. Today I'm going to read an article entitled "The Reality of Fake News" by Benoit Kampark. Fake news is a reality, the inability to navigate the waters in which it swims, a weakness in succumbing to material best treated with a huge pinch of salt. That, we are told, is the new condition of the global information environment. Laurel Seidel of the National Public Radio's All Things Considered furnished readers with one such example. The FBI agent suspected in Hillary email leaks found dead in an apparent murder-suicide. Shared over 500,000 times, it ran on a site that had the look and feel of a local newspaper. Eventually, a triumphant Seidel identified the individual in question behind the story. Justin Coder of Disinformedia got into fake news around 2013 to highlight the extremism of the white nationalist alt-right. This ushered in a life of information fakery, an attempt to publish blatantly fictional stories and then be able to publicly denounce those stories and point out that they were fiction. A dangerous dance is thereby initiated, one that assumes a false balance. The meat, as Kohler calls it, is consumed more enthusiastically by some than others. Naturally, his target was always going to be the more indignant and loudly cheering one. Conjuring up the fiction to then condemn it only goes so far. The beast eventually develops legs, scurrying away from the truth. This was very much the case in the reactions to supposed fake news stories. Some supporters would accept the product wholesale, ignoring the rebuttal. The Trump followers, claimed Kohler, were just waiting to eat up this red meat that they're about to get served. This led to something of a perversion. To prove a point, Kohler, as a registered Democrat, was effectively cultivating a market and exploiting it. He was even making money out of the credulous, even if they were backing another candidate. Again, the wheel on this score is being reinvented. To jump to conclusions that fake news sites are somehow new is only matched by the ignorance about what came before, the carefully doctored text to defame a minority, the false narrative about a race, idea, or culture, and the airbrushing of history. Traditionally, this misinformation business was reserved for the higher end of the news production cycle, a William Randolph Hearst or Robert Murdoch, or a director of propaganda operations in the government, totalitarian or otherwise, ever enthusiastic about spinning the story. The difference now is that the arm of dissimulation has extended to the ordinary citizen who has a huge array of sharing functions and social media platforms to spread the word. Information in this era, being treated as some magic gold dust, is being packaged and fed to the public via various mediums. The only thing interesting about this aspect is the democratization of production and dissemination. We are all potential directors of the fake news industry. In that sense, fake news has been a seamless incorporation into the commons, the decimation of fictions, supposition of fantasies made available like domestic crockery to the everyday citizens. The effects of mass democracy can be, in parts, hideous. Technologically, seen in conventional utopian circles as emancipative, has become the handmaiden for acts, conscientious or otherwise, of orchestrated mendacity. Rather than freeing the mind and adding a corrective to standard media accounts, it can supplant them, becoming their own form of tyranny. The digital giants of information, such as Google, claim that this phenomenon can be arrested by limiting advertising tools to websites in the service of fake news. Moving forward, said Google in a statement to Reuters, we will restrict ad serving on pages that misrepresent, misstate, or conceal information about the publisher, the publisher's content, or the primary purpose of the web property. This limited appraisal assumes that people engaged in the fake news business do so purely for business motivations. Only the money matters. But what of ideological motivation and basic malice? Perhaps it is far more fitting that we accept one logical consequence of this information revolution, that we are here on this planet to also misinform and spread the fleeting lie, which is always easier than the lumbering truth. Danger here is the speed that lie rushes into the digital sphere and eventually print. Rapid, it takes hold of the narrative and eventually supplants the truth. That was an article entitled The Reality of Fake News by Benoy Kampart, which can be found on the webpage Global Research. Benoy Kampart is a senior lecturer in the School of Global Urban and Social Studies at RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia.
There's not even room enough to be anywhere. It's not dark yet, but it's getting there.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives, to move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. Today's program will be on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments and find more links to more information about guests and topics as well as past programs. And if you'll recall, we will be playing an extended version of Bill Resnick's interview with Mark Brenner of Labor Notes on our webpage. That'll be up also in a couple of days. This is KBOO Portland.